Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks' Learning College, and today we're going to do Chapter 25 of Randolph O. Calverhall's Serpent's Walk. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Let's dig in. There's a long epigraph to start Chapter 25. You ask whether the party of humankind has a solution. Now, this is like a general addressing a throng of high school students. You ask whether the party of humankind has a solution for the crime problem? Thank you, young lady. The answer is yes. We are revising all of our laws and restructuring our procedures of law enforcement. We're rewriting the law books, standardizing, condensing, getting rid of the chaff, and putting the important statutes into language everyone can understand. We're using our biggest computers for this, machines that can read, digest, cross-reference, and collate 1,000 books an hour, and spit out the gist in book form. We're putting computer terminals in every police station, hospital, courthouse, prison, and government bureau. A single data bank will cover not only every state in the Union, but foreign nations that subscribe to our info network as well. Our computers analyze handwriting, check physical evidence, search data files, compare voice recordings, even do autopsies, all within minutes, and we're now using DNA genetic codes to tell whether a hair, a blood sample, or a bit of fiber, or a bit of tissue belongs to a given person. Loopholes and technicalities will be eliminated as evidence-gathering procedures are standardized. Moreover, we're working to develop safe, humane, and almost unbeatable interrogation techniques. Instead of weeks or months to prepare a case, most actions can go to court almost at once. What about lengthy trial delays, plea bargaining, uneven sentencing for similar offenses, crowded prisons, and the parole system? Computers and standardized legal system can't solve all of these problems, of course, but they will help. Straightforward cases with solid evidence and no extenuating circumstances can be decided by computer. After all, why not? Why waste time and money? Our sophisticated computers, checked by human judges, can handle about 80% of all cases. The rest will still require a judge and a jury. Computers will help in those cases, too, as will the condensation of our law books and a restructuring of our system. We're also going to allow our computers to consider behavior patterns, psychological profiles, and data from previous convictions. It'll be a lot tougher on the repeat criminal. Parole? Time off for good behavior? We're getting rid of both of these concepts. They're no more than revolving doors that put criminals back on the street. They're unevenly applied, and they haven't reduced crime one iota. We believe the law should say what it means and mean what it says. You do the crime, you do the time. We need other solutions to overcrowding and to filthy, demeaning, and dangerous prison conditions, of course. These problems only get worse if we convict more offenders, give stricter sentences, and end parole, as I have suggested. Jailing people is expensive, and it fails to produce the results we want. Reform behavior. Prisons are great schoolhouses for young criminals. They are sinkholes of drugs, AIDS, violence, and sexual aberration, and rehabilitation is as rare as angel feathers. Today, 74% of our prison population will get out, commit further offenses, and be sent back in for more meaningless incarceration. Rehabilitation simply doesn't result from jail time. We can't keep them in, and we don't want them out. The liberal solution is to mouth platitudes about improving the environment, creating jobs, and spending more money. Your money. We've seen how useless that is. You win a little here, you'll lose a lot there, and your problem keeps growing. Understand this, there is no kind solution. There is no way to reduce crime except to rid ourselves of the criminals. Sorrowfully and with all the compassion in the world, we must come to the only solution there is. We must put serious offenders to death, as humanely and gently as possible, without delay or exception. Uproar. Let me explain. The death penalty will only be applied to a person convicted of a major vicious crime or of a pattern of lesser vicious crimes, not a crime of passion or a one-time lapse, A vicious crime is one that is knowingly and willfully perpetrated and which involves premeditated and unwarranted violence, sadism, cruelty to a child or helpless victim, anti-state or anti-ethno-survival activity, or other aggravating factors. A first-time minor vicious offense will earn a person a sentence together with restraining and education, will earn a prison sentence together with retraining and education. That's for a first offense. A second offense will draw a longer term plus intensive therapy and a clear warning that this is the last chance. A third such crime will be punished by death. The sentence will be reviewed for accuracy and justice, but after that there will be no further delay or appeal. Unfair? Barbaric? Not at all. We must remove social units which malfunction and which damage other units around them. We must weed our garden, remove rotten apples from our barrel, destroy vicious dogs, and cull defective livestock. There is nothing inhumane about this. It is far more humane than returning offenders to prison to live out lives of hopelessness and degradation. The community, the ethnos, is our first responsibility. We must protect it from those who would destroy it. The ethnos owes nothing to antisocial individuals. No social contract exists unless both parties subscribe to it. The sanctity of human life? In which society was human life ever really sacred? Lip service is easy. How often we've heard, turn the other cheek. Tell me which nation ever actually followed that precept. We will maximize opportunities for positive development. To those who give, we will return tenfold. Only those who still cannot abide by our social contract after all remedies have been exhausted will be eliminated. This will be done with as much kindness and dignity as possible, but we will do it. We cannot afford to do otherwise. Who are we to judge, you ask? Who is anybody to judge anything? Who gives me the right to tell you not to park here, not to dump garbage in my driveway, not to steal my chickens? That's the social contract. You give us the right to act by electing us. If you disagree, then elect somebody else. If you accept our contract, then we will judge and we will carry out our program with as little hypocrisy and phony piety as possible. What about occasional miscarriages of justice? The poor man dragged off to die for a crime he did not commit. Such instances are rare. They will be rarer still once we get our technology in place. Fewer innocent persons will be convicted, and no one will ever be executed without a clear record of violent antisocial activity or recidivism. Poor people in prison now? Professional criminals with long records? They will finish their current sentences and then be released. They will also be told that the next time they commit a vicious offense, they will be put to death with no hesitation and no apology. The insanity plea? It will still be there for those who deserve it. We're devising better tests and treatments for those who suffer from mental ailments. The insanity plea won't be as easily available as before. However, we believe most people are rational enough to be responsible for their actions, whatever their childhood traumas or other psychological problems might be. We will be compassionate, that's all I promise you. No, sir, we do not intend to put traffic violators to death, no matter how many tickets they have. Laughter. Permanent loss of one's driver's license will be more common, however, and deaths or injuries resulting from drunken or careless driving are indeed vicious crimes. An automobile is a vicious weapon or a lethal weapon. What else? You in the front row, miss. Equality? Won't death sentences for serious offenders result in more blacks and other minorities being executed than whites? The answer is yes, at least in the short run, while the minorities remain among us. We will allow no inequity, however. All citizens are equal before the bar of justice. Factors that cause blacks or other minorities to commit more crimes than whites are another matter. They will be remedied as quickly as possible. We believe that emigration to a more ethnically homogeneous homeland is the best approach to this problem. Until our emigration program has been fully implemented, we will also correct the environment, improve education, and provide opportunities for those minorities who remain among us temporarily. What we will not tolerate is a high crime rate due to any cause. We are willing to weed our garden. If others among us are not willing to weed theirs, then we will do it for them. A last question. You, the young man with the glasses in the third row, what about lawyers? Is your law degree still going to be worth something once our judicial system is revamped? The answer is a qualified yes. We won't go so far as Shakespeare, the first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. Laughter. There will be less lawyers to do our computer as there will be less for lawyers to do as our computer network takes over certain functions, fewer appeals, fewer retrials, fewer lengthy corporate cases, fewer hung juries, fewer judgments dependent upon wealth, luck, charisma, or other personal factors. Lawyers will be needed to prepare evidence and advise clients. They may make less money than they do now, and they'll have to learn some new concepts of law. The muddle we have today cannot and will not be allowed to continue. That's where it ends, and that's from a discussion held with students at Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas, by Vincent Dorn, Monday, August 1st, 2050. And now, Chapter 25, Friday, August 5th, 2050. Not happy? Lisa stood by the window that looked out over the jigsaw puzzle of Seattle City Center. From the VIP penthouse on the top floor of the hospital, Puget Sound was visible beneath the tall gray buildings as a pool of silvery mercury spilled across a rumpled green baize horizon. Sure, Lessing replied, happy as a man can be with a full face of cotton wadding. He tried not to lisp. The wound in his cheek was nearly healed, but the stitches and plastic still felt awkward. He shifted to take the weight off his left side. Last Wednesday, the doctors had performed what they said would be the final operation on his shoulder, and it still hurt. In time, he'd regain the complete use of his arm, they told him. No prosthetics, no slings, not the black leather-clad hand that Wrench had offered to have 85 design, the one replete with a dagger, a tear gas projector, a stitch gun, and probably a 65-blade Swiss Army knife. He was reminded of a mad scientist in some movie he had seen in his childhood, a man whose artificial arm had a will of its own. Lisa drifted over to the bed. She sat on his right side to let him rub her neck with his good hand. Feels nice. It better. I spent weeks strengthening these fingers when they thought I was going to lose the arm. Green light soon. She twisted around to kiss him. Back to work now. She could be so cool and frustratingly remote. He said, you always have to go. Wait till I burst out of here. Lots to do. Lib Rebs. Outram too sick to do much. Vice President Lee an idiot. Mulder in seclusion. Goddard feuding with Wrench and Morgan. Yeah, I'm getting lost in the page here. Hey, we agreed that you'd use verbs in full sentences once in a while. He strove for a cheerful tone, but Lisa was in no mood for speech therapy. After a moment, he asked, so there's trouble between the cadre and phase? Capital P-H-A-S-E. Open squabbling? She made a face. No, covert. Mulder trying to keep them together. Damn politics. The party needs all its strength. The old power elite is going to make a comeback. The bureaucrats, the political parties, the religious sects, the CIA, the IRS, the corporations, all the pressure groups from big labor to save the prairie dogs. Business as usual. Shock of Starock wearing off. My God, after the death of half the country. Lisa took him literally. She said, not half. Census not in. 45 to 60 million Starock-related American casualties. Toxin itself, plus panic, starvation, other diseases. Maybe a billion dead from Pakov in Europe, Russia, Israel, Africa, parts of China, elsewhere. Pakov bacteria is supposed to die after one generation, but mutated to black Pakov in Africa instead. Most gone now, though. Gordy Monk rapped on the door. He was the chief of Lessing's squad of bodyguards. Sir, Cadre Commander Wren is here. Go, Lisa whispered. She reached for her charcoal gray autumn coat on the foot of the bed and started to get up. Stay, Lessing rapped back at her. It was hard to muster true authority with a mummy-wrapped shoulder and a cheek bandage that made him look like a lopsided squirrel. Wrench sidled around the door, winked at Lisa, then came on in. Today his cream-colored gabardine uniform was tasteful, and he had kept the medals and insignia down to a non-blinding minimum. Sit down, Lessing grumbled. Makes me nervous when people stand over me. Lisa went back to the window, but Wrench complied. He grinned at Lessing. Sorry to disturb you. Pay a call on the weak, the sick, and the elderly. Civic duty, you know. Weak, sick, elderly. Bullshit. I'm a goddamn hero, thanks to you. HomeNet is playing me up as the greatest military commander since Napoleon. And you run HomeNet. We believe in scrupulous honesty. All commercials, soap, game shows, jiggly bint babies, and tasteless violence the traffic will bear. Which are you? News? Lisa demanded impatiently. Wrench gave her a smile like sunrise. Knowing that our boy hero here doesn't get his daily dose of holovid, allow me to recapitulate the news. As HomeNet's greatest commentator, Jason Milne, says. He cleared his throat portentously. War breaks out between India and the Islamic theocracy of Indonesia-Malaysia. China intervenes and threatens a tactical nuclear strike unless Prime Minister Ramanujan's forces leave Cambodia, like real pronto. In Pakistan, the Red Mullah stays neutral, with one eye on Turkey to his west and the other on the Izzy Vizzies to his north. This worries his ophthalmologist. South Africa politely offers to surgically remove the U.S.-supported Nation of Allah Almighty, the Khalifa's folks, unless granted mineral rights in the Congo. Spanish forces help Morocco rescue hundreds from the ruins of fear earthquake-stricken Rabat. General Rawlins' troops have now reached Veracruz, bypassing Mexican units lurking in what's left of Mexico City after Sterak and the Big Fire. The confrontation between Peru and Brazil escalates. The White House dithers over whether to stop Central America and do away with the drug trade by the biblical method, fire and sword, or to take the dragster's bucks and shut up. Australia and New Zealand have gone inside, locked their doors, and put up a sign saying, "Nobody bloody well home. Go away and good day to you, mate." You make a better Jason Milne than Jason Milne does. All bad. Lisa shook her dark blonde tresses vehemently. No good news? Lessing said, "The world's a machine with a broken flywheel. It's coming to pieces." "We're what's holding it together," Wrench answered. "Our good old North European ethnos. Without us, the game would be over. We're actually gaining, doing good stuff internally, and helping sister organizations abroad. And allies among some really unlikely ethnos groups, too, like the Khalifa's Nation of Allah Almighty." "Khalifa Abdullah Sultani," Lisa began. "I think I met him once." Lessing saw a flicker of ice blue and an odd tremor crept into his voice. She smiled, puzzled. "Working with us, resettling black population in Africa. It's hard to imagine the Khalifa on our side. Why not? Good for his people. We help. Don't interfere." Wrench said, "Reorientation for black libreb prisoners includes courses taught by the Khalifa's people. We're sending him trained recruits, not a bunch of bang-nog gizmos. He gets what he wants, and we get what we both need, racial separation and room to grow." "Same in Central and South America," Lisa added. She picked up her coat again. "Re-education. They want it. We help. Party strongest in Argentina, Brazil." Lessing scowled. "I still get the feeling it's all coming apart. We have to win the Libreb war fast. Then we have to reunite. Otherwise, the wheels and springs fly off." Wrench showed his gleaming white teeth. "You're a great ugly clot of doom today, aren't you, Lessing? Let me give you some good news. San Francisco's about to fall. Last night, Tim Helms' guys and some regular units, Marines I think, busted through the Libreb lines north of Walnut Creek. They took the San Leandro Reservoir and pushed the opfos back to Pleasanton and Livermore. Best guess is that the Librebs may try to hold down by Fremont, but we've got them on the run and our artillery's setting up to shell Oakland and Berkeley from the hills. A good fireworks show may scare the Librebs out of San Francisco and save the city. Be ashamed to thumb it." "Why do they fight on?" Lisa wondered, sadly. "Can't win." "Same reason we'd keep going," Lessing told her, "because there's nowhere else to go. Not for their side." He struggled up and began brushing his pale hair. It was becoming noticeably thinner. Wrench said, "Times change. A century ago, they said we were finished, out in the garbage dump of history. Now it's their turn. The wheel's gone around a full circle. Skirts go up, then down, then up again. About a 20-year cycle. 85 says that whenever there's a major upheaval, like Pakov, there's also a tendency toward authoritarian politics. The liberals were up, now they're down. As outdated as Whig powder, we are the big kids in the block now. And believe me, we're looking real hard for ways to keep the swing from dropping us back into the shit pile again. Lessing didn't want to talk politics. Let me ask, first things first. Wrench got up and twisted the holovid dial until he found a Yowling Banger concert on Yamanet. He bent close to Lessing and motioned Lisa over as well. Just so we don't hear a voice saying, "Speak louder into the bedpan, please." Lessing raised a sarcastic eyebrow. "Oh, come on, security on the brain." "Relax. Goddard's been getting feisty lately. He set up files in 85 that I can't get into. Neither can Outrem's trained SEALs." "I wasn't asking about Goddard. He's got eyes and ears right here in your hospital, boudoir, you know. But we can't find his mics." Wrench made a vague, circling gesture into the ceiling. "Anyway, I know it's Hollister you want to hear about. The Euromercs haven't seen him since he pulled out of the Izzy's colony in Ufa months ago. We're sure he's in Lib-Reb territory." "For that, you need a mega-billion-buck computer?" "Easy. We'll find the Gubbert. You needn't worry. Plenty of security." He snickered. "Even got guys sniffing your pee for slow-acting poisons. No more funny teddy bears." Lessing lay back down. "Those people, our people, died because of me. Ken Swanson with a plastic star in his brain. The Librebs, too. Gottschalk and his woman." "You couldn't help what Hollister did. Nobody blames you or the cadre either. Your guys didn't know what the pog was happening. The peaceniks roasted us for thumbing prisoners, and the good folks up at DNET in Montreal are raising a holy stink about war crimes. But the public's on our side. Nobody expects soldiers in a combat zone to react any differently to a bomb tossed, literally into their soup." "The memories hurt," he said. "Jennifer came here to see me. I was worried about her." "Smart girl. When the teddy bear blew its stack, good old Jenny was flat on her back with some doggy under a table." "Not fair," Lisa cried. "Mullet. It was Arlen Mullet, wounded and protecting her. Threw it down when Alan yelled." "Oh, I know." Wrench put out a hand in the closest thing to apology Lessing had seen him make. "Just a dumb joke. Jen and Mullet are green light now, though he couldn't sit down for a couple weeks, and Jen's got shrapnel scars across her back. She's gone back east to Goddard's phase headquarters in Bethesda, Maryland. She'll be closer to Mulder there, too." "Is Arlen still at Cadre Officers Training School in Denver?" Lessing owed his aid to the big one. Mullet had said, "Mr. Det meant Mr. Death." Without that warning, Lessing would have ignored the little girl with the teddy bear. He would have died. So would a lot of other people. "Yeah, he's happy. Got a card from Stan Crawford, too. He's driving for Tim Holm now on the San Francisco front, or Helm. Patty, the kid who brought me Hollister's present, is here in the hospital in the burn unit. I couldn't block all the hot soup when I fell on her. Do me a favor and go see her."
"I have, a couple of times."
"Me too," Lisa said. "Often."
"Patty's physically as good as new," Lessing swallowed. "She's not over it, but she's coming. Did you find out her last name?"
"Not yet. She sure as hell wasn't Gottschalk's kid, nor any relation to that kosher wildcat he had with him. Patty remembers her name was something like Hoyer or Hoyer, E-U-E-R or O-Y-E-R, and we think she came from Eureka. The war destroyed the records, though, and, well, we're just not sure." "A loose casualty of war." Suddenly the tension pent up within him poured out in a single ragged snarl. "God!" Lisa touched his good hand. "Hey, hey, green light. Changed my mind. No work. Lunch. With Patty and Wrench. Tall Pines Restaurant. Pretty day. Lake Washington." Lessing's anguish was contagious. It was playing havoc with Lisa's speech. "As I was saying about Goddard..." Wrench, too, saw the danger of letting Lessing brood upon the lava beds massacre. "Well?" "Let me warn you, when Outrem goes, there'll be a power struggle like you wouldn't believe, a real rough and tumble. It'll be time to choose up sides and smell armpits." Lessing glanced over at Lisa. She wrinkled her nose. Wrench's Goddardophobia might be no more than his usual paranoia, wherever there was an extreme. Wrench seemed to delight in going beyond it. "Still, Goddard was quite capable of an end run for the touchdown." "Lunch." Lisa picked up the telephone and dialed. After a moment, she turned to Lessing. "Lunch. Downstairs. Patty." He dressed, favoring his injured shoulder,
Two of his bodyguards stayed in the hospital room. The other four accompanied them down in the elevator and fanned out into the parking garage. They checked Lessing's black Titan 909 party sedan, then joined Wrench's squad in their two escort cars. So much security struck Lessing as unnecessary. Hollister had had plenty of chances to thumb him. A shot from a passing car, a sniper in a rooftop, walk up the street and unzip him with a kitchen knife. Wrench was obsessed with Goddard more than Hollister, of course. He was also worried about the Lib Rebs, the Izzy Vizzies, and probably Dracula and the Loch Ness Monster as well. Some of his fears were not entirely groundless. Patty pushed through the glass doors, trailed by one of the bodyguards and a nurse. Lessing found her beautiful, a skinny, lively child of 6, maybe 7, who knew, with eyes as pale blue as Lessing's own. She had shoulder-length, sunblonde hair, which she combed, teased, permed, braided, and manipulated in whatever other way the Holovid Bint babies did theirs. Today, Patty wore a white blouse and black jeans, the party's unofficial kid suit. In a more peaceful world, she could have been Lisa and Lessing's daughter. "Hi, Lessing," she always called him that, just his last name, mostly consisted of splatters across her right arm and shoulder. The pain was mostly gone now, but she still had nightmares. "Hi, you in the mood for salmon? Crab legs?" Patty flicked a self-conscious glance at the watching security men. "No, spaghetti." "Seafood," Lisa announced. "My vote." The little girl shrugged. "You're buying." She'd get her way. Lisa would give in. The Tall Pines restaurant was new and glossy, the sort of place beloved of businessmen and the supper crowd, a yuppie suppy, Wrench called it. This afternoon, a third of the tables were occupied by civilians and another third by soldiers home on leave from California, but the remaining places were empty. It took a while for tourism and gracious living to return to normal after losing upwards of 45 million customers. Lessing slitted his eyes and saw peace, a drowsy August afternoon with pleasant people enjoying good food and comfortable surroundings in a happy land. He saw summer. Time to go up to the San Juan Islands, over to the Olympic Peninsula, maybe to Mount Rainier. He did not see war, soldiers, tanks, and guns. Pakov and Starak. Armageddon. It was like in combat, when you can't stand to think of bullets and pain and death any longer, your mind turns off. You look at the sky, the weeds in your foxhole, the color of the rocks, the patterns made by runnels of sweat and the dust in front of your nose. During the past weeks, lying in his hospital bed, Lessing had come to a decision. He would give in to Lisa Wrench and Mulder and join the party of humankind. It might not provide, quote, balanced, moderate, open-minded, liberal solutions, but it was better than anything else going. The party promised peace, prosperity, stability, progress, and love. Love? He had thought it over and it was true. The party's foes did not see its policies as love, of course, especially its racial politics and the exclusivity of it, the ethnos. Yet love was the essence, love of one's people, love of one's heritage, love of those with whom one empathized and identified. The Party of Humankind offered love, love in the societal sense, the only type of love that made survival sense. The party, the movement, had an uncompromising ideology and a stern discipline, but it also seemed to be the best means of keeping humanity, all of the ethnos groups, alive on Earth. Their cadre uniforms got them a table right away, and the waitress took their order. "School?" Lisa inquired of Patty. The child favored her with a level, blue gaze. "September 10th, third grade. Missed a year because of the war." She rarely spoke of the week she had spent in the lava beds. Her memories of that place were mostly of cold and hunger and smelly tents and caves and noise and terror. Gottschalk and his strange companions had dwindled away to become dream figures. Children were more flexible at forgiving and forgetting than adults. "Which school?" Wrench asked idly. The waitress was busy with a party of brown-uniformed phase officers two tables away, and he was keeping an eye on them. "Oak Tree." Party schools were named for positive natural images. Patty took a spoonful of mushroom soup, then gasped. "Wow, that's hot." "Excuse me," Wrench muttered. He rose and pushed through the crowd to the phase men's table. One of his bodyguards dawdled along after him. "All education equal in our new schools," Lisa said to Lessing. "Same curriculum everywhere. Same tests, standardized. Teachers nationally trained and licensed. Frequent transfers to other cities and states to maintain uniformity. No tuition." "Those are Wrench's ideas. He loves tinkering with things like educational reforms." Lessing, too, was watching the phase men. Mulder's pushing Wrench for Secretary of Education and Information. "Too radical sometimes. Should think more about reforms first. Like a certain blonde revolutionary lady I know." They smiled at each other, and Lisa put out a hand, but did not quite touch his. They were together a lot these days. They hadn't talked of marriage. Many people no longer wanted to risk the legal hassle just for a piece of paper, but both felt a growing commitment. Patty glanced from one to the other. "Wrench says school will cost a lot." She gave Lessing a big blue-eyed I love you look. "Lessing, you gonna pay for me?" He laughed. Her grown-up ploys continually amazed him. "Don't have to. It's in the party plan. Free school for everybody." He thought about Wrench's struggle to make education a top party priority. 85 had had to do some fiscal footwork, even though a fat military budget was no longer as urgent as it used to be. Pakov and Starok had taken care of keeping up with the Soviets and Chinese. There were other priorities, of course. The Lib-Rev war disaster relief, reorganizing the shattered economy, national medical care, aid to the elderly, farm subsidies, a lot of things. Yet education was the key. American education had been a haphazard house of cards built upon foundations of sand. Western civilization wouldn't last long in the hands of illiterates. Bring your kids up to the standard of students in Japan, the blossoming Turkish Empire, the izzy-vizzy Russian colonies, and a revitalized Europe, or else watch while those other ethnos groups shouldered you aside and ran the planet their way. Sweeping reforms were hard, though. The academic establishment was as crusty and conservative in practice as its educational policies were doggedly liberal. A step in any direction gored somebody's ox and provoked loud literate cries of outrage. The Party of Humankind had to take advantage of the country's post-Pakov disruption and do something before the old boys' clubs regained control. Once that happened, it would be business as usual. Committees and reports and task forces and meetings and bullshit bureaucracy until it was too late. It was almost too late now. Party schools, youth camps, parental organizations, sports groups, scholarships, curricular revisions, Wrench had laid out a whole agenda of changes, and Mulder was doing his best to see that they got them. As somebody once said, "Give me the children until they are seven, and anyone else may have them afterwards." It's more of a Jesuit saying, Catholic. Lessing came back to Patty. He would do everything in his power to see that she got the best. What was she to him? Why did he care so much? He wasn't sure. He had never been much for introspection. Examining your innermost feelings, clearly and objectively, was like trying to peek up your own asshole. Contortionists could do that, but Lessing, along with a couple billion others, could not. Was Patty just a sop for all the guilt he carried around with him? Like Atlas with the world in his shoulders? Be nice to this one child and thus atone for the deaths of half the planet, whether he was guilty of those deaths or not? Or was he atoning for the Lava Beds massacre? No, neither. He wasn't much for guilt trips. Guilt made him think of his mother. Guilt was the mainspring of her life. In her flinty way, she believed that God would take away her guilt on Judgment Day. After all, hadn't Jesus Christ died for her sins? Whatever she did was already forgiven. If God got snotty with her, she could point over at Jesus and proclaim, "He's already paid my tab, Lord." Then she'd weep, get down on her bony knees, and repent like she was humping for an Academy Award. God would surely see things her way. Christianity and the other Middle Eastern religions were certainly alike in one respect. They all sweated over sin. The ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead had a great judgment scene, Lessing had read somewhere. When you died, Thoth, T-H-O-T-H, the ibis, that's the bird, ibis-headed god, weighed your heart against the feather of truth. You confessed your sins before Osiris, the Lord of the Dead, and if you lied, you were lunch for a crocodile-headed monster. Needless to say, this sternly moral scene was followed by other chapters that told you how to lie safely to the 42 judges of the dead, how to con Osiris, how to fool old Krakow Smile, and how to sashay on into the fields of the blessed without anybody laying a hand, claw, or tentacle on you. Why did all the religions from this part of the world bother postulating an omnipotent, omniscient God, an all-powerful, all-knowing God, who handed down ironclad commandments, only to spend the rest of history figuring out ways to bamboozle him? Must be something in the Middle Eastern psyche. Patty jogged his arm for the salt shaker, and Lessing returned to reality with a palpable jolt. If somebody had suggested that Patty, all by herself, were a complete and sufficient reason for love, he wouldn't have known what to say. Wrench slid back into his chair, polished his silverware on his napkin, and devoured his chowder in uncharacteristic silence. By the time their entrees arrived, however, he was telling Patty fantastic stories about Indian elephants and Maharajas. Lessing watched him curiously. The salmon steak was good, and Lisa's prawns were perfect. There was no spaghetti on the menu, but Patty allowed herself to be satisfied with her braised beef, even so. She was definitely no seafood lover. The winking garnet goblets, the tablecloths of red damask, and the silver-gleaming cutlery took Lessing back to the restaurant in Sioux City, where his parents had celebrated their anniversaries. The memory was as hazy as candle smoke, yet it was immensely comforting. Angola and Syria and India and Pune and Palestine and New Sverdlovsk faded away. They had never happened. Pakov and Sterak were meaningless acronyms on file covers and some forgotten desk. This was reality. A buzz of conversation near the door caused him to glance in that direction. Half a dozen tall men in black uniforms had entered the restaurant and were looking around. One of them spotted Lessing, motioned his sable-hued comrades to wait, then made his way slowly along the aisle toward their table. Something stirred deep in Lessing's memory, but did not make it to the surface. He watched warily as the stranger approached. "Hey, Lessing, you pugger!" Wrench crowed in his ear. "Do you know who that gizmo is?" "Bill Easley, Cadre from Kansas." The youth who bent over their table had a friendly, hawk-beaked Midwestern face with a toothy grin. "Remember me, sir?" He extended a hand. Lessing's memory finally yielded up a few faint images from the past, and he husked, "Yeah, sure, I haven't seen you in a long time. New Orleans, was it? What are you doing now?" "Second Louis, sir. Cadre's Victory Battalion. Brand new, like your own American Freedom Brigade. We're down near Lake Tahoe, guarding the Lib-Reb prisoners from Sacramento and Fresno until they're handed on to FaZe." The hero worship in Easley's voice was thick enough to pour over pancakes. He pointed back toward the clump of Cadre uniforms by the door. Could my friends come over and meet you, sir?" "Fine, glad to say hello." Lessing was back in control. "Prisoners?" Wrench asked sharply. "FaZe?" "Yes, sir. Cadre Commander Wrench, isn't it?" Easley had met him too, but Wrench wasn't military. He attracted fewer groupies. "Aren't Lib-Reb POWs supposed to be shipped immediately up into Oregon?" Wrench persisted. Easley wasn't interested. "Yes, sir, they are, but we pass them on to FaZe first for screening out the hard cases. You know, FaZe mostly sends them on to Oregon, just keeps a few of them, not like POWs, but some of the civilians' families like." He beckoned his companions. "Men, my buddies are on leave till we start getting prisoners in from San Francisco." "God damn it," Wrench hissed. "Lessing, we have to talk." "Later." He refused to think about the Cadre and FaZe. Wrench read Lessing's mood and let the matter drop for the moment. They greeted Easley's friends, four young Cadre men who gawked and shook hands and uttered stumbling courtesies. These were Lessing's fans, just as if he were a banger star, and they must not go away disappointed. When dessert and coffee were finished, Wrench went over to Easley's table, and Lessing saw him pick up their check. Wrench had to be the greatest public relations man since P.T. Barnum. They drove back to the hospital in a well-fed stupor. Wrench watched Patty's escort take her up in the elevator, and then he said, "Gotta find the kid a home. She can't live all her life in a hospital." Lessing grimaced. "I can't take her. Another week and I'm back with my unit. A military camp would be no good for her. Lisa, I know you don't have time and no place for her either." Wrench jabbed the elevator button. "Same here. Jennifer has a great apartment, of course." He saw Lisa's look and smoothly changed gears, but Jen's lifestyle might not be suitable for a young girl, to put it politely. Mrs. Mulder. As soon as he spoke, Lessing knew he was right. Lisa nodded emphatically, and Wrench banged the button a second time. Perfect, man. Patty gets spoiled rotten in the lap of decadent luxury. Let the fairy godmother stuff her with cookies and cake frosting. They'll both love it. He rubbed his hands together, then sobered. Now we have another more serious problem for discussion. Lessing sighed. His mood of gentle peace was fading fast. Goddard and FaZe? Yeah. Listen, why don't you both come downtown with me to the Corn Link at party headquarters? We have to talk to Goddard. Matter? He's asked. Urgent? You heard easily. Lib-Reb prisoners are supposed to go straight from holding camps back of our front lines to reorientation villages in Oregon. Goddard's FaZe guys are screening them and taking some away. Why and where, Easley didn't know. I caught it, Lessing said. What the hell is that about? Who knows? Lib-Reb prisoners are military and cadre business. FaZe doesn't have the authority to grab prisoners. Goddard can make up the authority. The Lib-Rebs emptied the jails all over the Southwest and Mexico to get their troops. He can say that his boys are screening for criminals and escaped felons. Yeah, I suppose he can, Wrench mused. Mulder persuaded Outram to make FaZe a federal agency and let it coordinate all police functions across the country. Dumb. Outram could have used the FBI and saved us all from Bill Goddard. Outram doesn't trust the FBI. President Rubin packed it with smart-ass Eastern establishment lawyers who used to chase Outram's right-wing friends around the block. But prisoners, Lisa put in? Civilians? Families? Why? Not partisans or saboteurs. You thinking what I'm thinking? Lessing asked her. Special squads and necktie parties? Bill's views of minority affairs start about a mile to the right of where Attila the Hun leaves off. He wouldn't do that, she flared back. We want trust, not death camps, party directive. Okay, green light, but if Big Bear Bill is doing what people used to accuse the Third Reich of doing, then he's going to run smack into me. I never signed off on that kind of stuff. Give Goddard a chance, Wrench protested. We don't know anything yet. I'm going to put in a call to him, then another to Mulder. Lisa frowned. Alan and I? Do? Wrench slammed the elevator button again. You, Lisa, have been with the movement a long time. You can talk to Bill, and you, Lessing, command the American Freedom Brigade. You can order your officers not to cooperate with FaZe until we know what's going on. Doing what with prisoners? Lisa rubbed her bare arms as though she were cold. Wrench answered her. He could be doing just what Easley said, screening for hard cases with everything legal and proper by the book. He could also be playing water sports, Lessing contradicted. You know, fly prisoners out over the Pacific and see how they swim home. Wrench held the elevator door for Lisa. One way to find out. Come on, let's go down to my office. It was 4 o'clock before they reached the party headquarters opposite the old public safety building on 3rd and Cherry. 20 years ago, this truncated pyramidal skyscraper of black glass and steel had been erected to house tentacles of the King County Administrative Octopus. Seattle and King County. After Sterak, the Army and the Decontamination Services had taken it over, although Seattle had missed being hit for reasons no one knew, Outram's martial law government had then occupied the lower floors for the next 2 years, while the remainder stayed empty. Now the building was refurbished, bright with American flags and party bunting, and thronged with staffs on their way home from work. Wrench shepherded them through the crowd, secured an elevator, produced a key, and pushed a button. The capsule-like something up the outside of the pyramid at stomach-clutching speed. Oh, I see. The capsule-like car raced up the outside of the pyramid at stomach-clutching speed. The doors opened on the 25th floor to reveal a square tablet of white light floating in the air. The hologram displayed the letters of blue fire, : Party of Humankind, Department of Information. Whom do you wish to see? Wrench said, Director's Office. The hologram changed to read, Please look into the iPrint box on the wall to your left and state your full name. They obeyed and the hologram glided away down the corridor, flashing, Follow me, please, in luminous red. Wrench almost glowed. He said, Neat, eh? And security all the way. He pointed up at the camera eye in the ceiling. 85 is watching us, watching everybody. Hell, in a year or two, we won't need ID cards at all. Everything will be done with eye and voice prints. Big brother. Bull. That's gungo, as the bangers say. Hell, America's been under surveillance for almost a century. Cops, the IRS, credit checks, social security numbers, the FBI, you name it. Moreover, 85 can sniff out most crimes right now without adding a single chip. All we're doing is consolidating existing data banks. Today it takes 12 minutes to scan some gizmo's records in 51 states and 6 foreign countries. A week for a big corporation. With every computer system shaking hands with 85, we'll have that info within seconds. But average folks won't get hurt. And we'll catch and convict the crooks, scammers, welfare frauds, and credit card weasels. A lot of crime from checking into big check hiding to big corporate hanky-panky will be as passé as stagecoach robbery. It'll be technically impossible. People will protest like crazy. And they'll get used to it. They'll get real happy when they see what we save them in taxes, crime protection, and other ways. Folks are fed up with laws that don't work. Rich lawyers, whimsical judges, and crooks that wriggle through the system like worms through a dog's gut. Our penal system's as outdated as the Bastille. We're working with Outram's allies in Congress to push some changes through. We may need amendments to the Constitution to do it, but we'll get it done. Everything legal, 100% gubbin percent. Extreme, yeah, draconian, I like that word. It's what America the world needs. Tough love. You really should strain this through 85 a few more times before you bottle it. We have. 85 predicts acceptance within 5 years. You and it could still be wrong. Lessing wanted to rub his cheek, but that would hurt. Wrench halted before a huge double door whose leaves were seamless sheets of burnished copper. He threw out his arms dramatically and cried, "Open sesame!" To his companions he whispered, "Doesn't matter what you say, the voice print's what counts. Doesn't matter what you say, the voice print is what counts." "Did you know about these changes?" Lessing murmured to Lisa as they followed Wrench inside. "Not everything. I, my staff, busy. Popularize the party. Dorn. Need to convince the folks down home. A police state that makes the Soviet Union's gulag look as laid back as a banger snuffy-doo orgy." Lisa bridled. "Totalitarian state, not necessarily cruel or brutal. Good government doesn't harm good citizens, solves social problems, helps economy, deters crime, efficient aid for needy, old, sick, mentally ill. Benefits outweigh restrictions." "You're great at summing up the party platform, love, but people will balk at government by supercomputer. It's not cricket, as the British say." Wrench had paused inside the ornate reception room to stare into another blink box beside a glass door leading to a complex of inner offices. He grinned back at them. "Not cricket. That's just it, Lessing. We're not playing cricket. We're talking law. Nobody mentioned good table manners or the code of the West. Fair is protecting the citizens. Unfair is letting the wolves go on munching on the sheep." "Logically, you're right, but people don't always see things logically, and it's people you're dealing with." Wrench sniffed. "People need education. Then they'll see that what we're doing is best for our ethnos. For the world, man." Wrench's office was austere, almost monkish, a long room with one glass wall overlooking the dizzy drop down the face of the pyramid, past roofs and wharves and ferry boats to Elliott Bay. Lessing glimpsed work tables, swing lights, green glazed cabinets, and a half dozen unoccupied desks. A niche in one of the inner walls contained a photographic hologram of children playing volleyball before a brick school building. It was now after 4 in the afternoon and the staff had gone home. "Hello, Cadre Commander Wren." 85's smooth Melissa Willoughby voice emerged eerily from nowhere. "Program Director Meisinger, Mr. Lessing." Wrench said, "Access, encode, protect, and create a safe file. Name it Goddard-com. Find Bill Goddard." "Face Commander Goddard is in his office in Bethesda, Maryland. Do you require further location coordinates?" "No, establish contact." The hologram of the schoolchildren blinked out, and Bill Goddard appeared in his place. He sat at a cluttered work table surrounded by a computer terminals, communications gear, and a half a dozen phase personnel, among whom Lessing recognized Chuck Gillen and Dan Grote from Ponape. Plastic plates, coffee cups, and an empty orange-spattered pizza carton littered the files and documents in front of Goddard and his crew. 85 a caught phase in the middle of a supper-cum-staff meeting. Goddard looked up at the camera, surprise evident upon his fleshy features. "Well, well," he leaned back in his chair, "Mary and her two of her little lambs." Wrench started to make a sarcastic reply, but Lessing cut him short. "Bill, can we talk?" "Without the personalities?" Goddard pursed his lips. "Why not?" All three spoke at once, but Lessing got the floor. "We have a problem." He related what Easley had told Wrench. Goddard shook his grizzled head. "You're an amazing dinker, Lessing. What kind of caca do you smoke? Of course FaZe is screening LibRep prisoners in California for the best reasons in the world. Some of them are criminals with records long enough to step on. Some are SKPs. Some are assassins who'd make a beeline for Outremer, Mulder, or you, if we let them go. Some are Vizzies, the same lovely bunch who dropped Sterak on us. Remember, what do you expect? Of course FaZe is looking at him." "Okay, okay," Wrench tried to mollify him. "But without consulting Lessing here, or Mulder, or Outram? Shit, we don't need consultation. FaZe has federal police powers. And we did inform your guys on the scene. Check with home." "Or hell, told you so," Lessing muttered to Wrench. "Anyway, we don't grab off many of your librebs. We question them, pull out those on the wanted list, and hand your guys legal warrants. I guess we picked up a couple hundred of their laughable soldier boys that way. No more. The rest we gave back to you, and you're welcome to them." Wrench bit his lip. "I was told that FaZe was grabbing off a lot of librebs. More than a couple hundred, anyway. Not all military, either, but civilians and families." "Gubbit, you're crazy. No such thing. Why would we want them? We don't have camps, tents, personnel." His eyes widened. "And don't tell me we're taking them off and shooting them. Don't try to pin that on FaZe." A voice off camera said something, and Goddard grunted. "Hell, I'm told that our guys in California think you're disappearing some libreb boogies. Quite a few of them never made it to Oregon. We were about to ask you where the bus stopped." "What?" Lessing was baffled. "I don't..." Wrench said, 85, you listening?" "Damn it, of course you are. Compare cadre list of libreb POWs taken in Sacramento with arrival rosters at the reorientation centers in Oregon. Print out any names not on both lists and check for reasons why." "You should have done that before you came hollering at me," Goddard complained. He addressed 85 also. "Compare those cadre lists with FaZe files of librebs taken into custody in California and Oregon." It took less than 10 seconds. A box appeared in the Cornlink hologram to the left of Goddard's face. Names scrolled past. "Hard copy that," Wrench commanded. A printer began to whine behind him. Goddard pointed at his own screen. "Jesus, look. They're mostly Jewish names. Rosenbaum, Siegel, Greenberg, Silverstein, Levine, Aaron. Isn't Daniel Jacoby the producer who made Train to Darkness, the movie that came out a few years ago about World War II? Lessing asked. "You know, the Treblinka camp. Bella Gould starred in it." "Yes." Lisa reached past him for the printout. "Reuben Meyer, financier, corporate raider. Marvin Weisskopf?" Wrench dug fingers into his wavy brown hair. "Hey, I met that guy. Theoretical physics professor, MIT. 85, provide dossiers on these people." The printer churned and paper piled up in the out tray. A name caught Lessing's eye. He bent down and read, "Arthur Shapiro, consultant, American Zionist Action Committee of New York. Age 59, male, divorced." He saw a white-wrapping mummy spread-eagled amidst the glittering implements. Horror. Ice blue. The printer stopped. "What? Where are these people?" Lisa glared at Goddard. The big man scowled back. "Not with us. Not FaZe. Ask Wrench there, or Lessing." "You're thumbing prisoners," Lessing accused angrily. "Vanishing them. Vanishing them. Like in South America, death squads, the desaparecidos that disappeared." "Bullshit," Goddard roared back. "Not my people. FaZe is more disciplined than that. You half-assed toy soldiers now. 85, list the units that took custody of the people who were disappeared, Wrench ordered. There must be documents, authorizations, transport food, supplies, fuel for trucks, records, damn it. The machine said, Phase, Special Unit F near Sacramento, Phase, Special Unit M at Red Bluff. I can provide details if you wish. Goddard shoved his ruddy face forward almost into the camera lens. What the pog are you talking about? We don't have any such units. There is no Special Unit F, no M either. Somebody's fucking well lying. His eyes swiveled right to stare at the screen in Phase headquarters. Lessing and his companion saw the same thing on theirs, a blue and gold shield upon which the words U.S. Government, Access Restricted, now flashed angry scarlet. Before they could speak, the hologram changed again. The shield was replaced by a man's face, squarish, mottled, pallid pink, with ice-chip blue eyes and hair like tendrils of white frost. His expression was a mixture of surprise, wariness, and something like hostility. Just what is it you're looking for? Janos Korenek inquired mildly in his high, piping, reedy voice. And that is how Chapter 25 concludes. It would appear, I'm going to guess, because I have not read this before. I'm doing it as we go. Appears that somebody has taken over a little bit of the situation, is trying to liberate the Jews. But we'll see in subsequent chapters. Anyway, thanks for being with me today. You've been listening to Alex Linder reading from Randolph O. Calverhall's, a very unusual name, Serpent's Walk, a novel from 1991. And you can find this recording and everything we record at vnnforum.com, also later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll pick up with Chapter 26.